Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSR HealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Welcome to Way of the Dreamer. This is a show where we affirm the power of dreams, coincidence, and imagination to make our lives richer and juicier and open new fields of possibility. I'm very happy my guest today is Kelly Bulkley. He's written a new book amongst his many books on one of my favorite subjects, which is keeping a dream journal. The title is The Scribes of Sleep. The subtitle is Insights from the Most Important Dream Journals in History. We'll hear about those in a moment. Kelly is a prolific author. He's a leading dream researcher. He's written some excellent books about dreaming and the history of religion and the science of dreaming. And he is currently, I believe, director of something called the Sleep and Dreams Database, about which we might hear something in a moment. Just before we bring him on, I'll note early in his new book, The Scribes of Sleep, he gives some information from the database, telling us that about half the men and women in America remember a dream once a week, or more often, and have obviously told someone that, and more than 90% remember a dream at least once every few months, and that 20% of women and 14% of men actually share their dreams with someone at least once a week. These are sort of somewhat reassuring statistics, although, of course, not too impressive to prolific dream recallers who are keeping journals. What is rather dismal is that the practice of recording dreams in anything like a journal is not appreciated and not practiced in the United States, or I would think in any Western country these days. 80% of men and women say they never recalled their dreams, which is really so unfortunate because they're missing out on so much, aren't they, Kelly? Because keeping a dream journal is a fantastic enterprise. Let's start at your beginning in this context, because you tell us the origin story, as you call it, yes, of how you came to keeping a dream journal and understanding it's important on a beach in Kauai after you spent 6 weeks at Fort Knox doing push-ups and being rousted out of bed at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, it was not probably a typical start to a career as a dream researcher, but in retrospect, it all kind of makes sense now. I had gone to an ROTC Reserve Officer Training Corps basic camp for 6 weeks, not because I wanted to join the military, but actually, to be honest, to kind of exercise the militaristic demons that had always I've been aware of through my adolescence. And so that camp was quite an experience. But then I went and visited some friends and went backpacking in Kauai, just to kind of totally clear my head. And I brought Anne Faraday's Dream Power, one of the early books of kind of the latter part of the 20th century sort of renaissance of interest in dreams. And I started thinking about my dreams, and here I am, 40 some odd years later,
And you started recording them. This is when you started the journal, correct?
Yeah. Once I started putting the dreams down, in my case, and back down on paper, and just keeping track of them over time, like, it doesn't take long for patterns to emerge and new insights, kind of meta insights, you know, beyond what one dream can reveal, but like, wow, look at that, like, over the course of those 10 dreams, you know, let's say the trickster, whoa, look at all those trickster figures, like, what's that about? It really changed my life, yeah.
You tell us that as you began paying more attention to your dreams, for example, by keeping the journal, the dreams started paying more attention to you, which is a sort of nice way of looking at it. The patterns of dreaming changed as you saw more in them. Tell us, as you look over all these years, because 1981, when you're on the beach in Kauai reading a book from 1974, you know, I'm a historian too, you know. That's a long time ago. I mean, that's more than 40 years ago. So as your practice of keeping a journal has continued and evolved, tell us how that works. Tell us, you know, whether you've learned new tricks in terms of how you keep a journal and what you bring from it.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's always a journey of discovery. You know, I think that's the fun of it. There's always surprise. There's always something new that emerges from the unconscious. And I think as we widen our lens of perception to perceive what's going on in our dreams, we see more. And that dialogical process, you know, that you quote me on, like, you know, the more we pay attention to our dreams, the more they pay attention to us. That is my experience, and others with whom I've spoken that there's a kind of interactive quality to working with dreams over time. And so, yeah, you know, I would say to keep things fresh, and, you know, I'm always trying, anybody's new method comes along, I'll give it a try, see what my dreams think of it. You mentioned early on the Sleep and Dream database, which is an online digital archive of information about sleep and dreams, dream reports, surveys, historical records, and it's a public resource. It's also kind of my mad scientist laboratory in a way, where I've been experimenting with tools of digital analysis to see what works. And I've been you know, for example, I was an ardent foe of content analysis at the time I was writing my dissertation and early days, and then I realized, if I tweak this a little bit, if I adjust some of the tools and apply them according to interests that I have, not Calvin Hall's or Robert Van de Castle's or Bill Donlof's, maybe there's some things I could learn, and lo and behold, a lot has come from that. So, yeah, that's on and on it goes.
We're going to come to you in your U-turn on the subject of content analysis in a moment, Kelly. I must say I found it a bit shocking when I came to that powerful, then I saw how important it was going to be, and I decided to give it a whirl and actually, you know, be agnostic and wait and see what came through. But a lot of people listening to us keep journals. They keep dream journals. They keep journals in a more general sense. So one thing they want to know right now is, they want to know more about the nitty-gritty of how you keep a journal. And when it comes to dreams, when do you write them down? Do you start by writing? Yeah. Do you go to the keyboard? Do you use a voice recorder? What time of day? What time of night are you doing this stuff? What does your journal look like? Do you run searches in your own journal? They want to hear from you. And let's put it to you like this. Let's hear from you about your own personal practice in as much detail as you're willing to share.
Sure. No, well, it almost everybody's work, I think, in this field grows out of their own personal practice, at least mine does. So, I keep a dream, I keep a blank notebook by my bedside and a pen. I'll do a little pre-sleep, let's say an incubatory practice of just kind of, there it is, there's the journal, there's the pen. So if anything comes to mind, I'll scribble it down either during the night or first thing in the morning. I find if I allow myself, if I allow any significant time and certainly any activities with light and the waking world, I'll lose the memory very quickly. So I try to write down as much as I can right away. But then if I don't transcribe that within a few hours, and usually I try to do that after breakfast or after lunch, you know, some point up before middle of the day, if I wait any longer than that, I can't read my own writing.
Right.
If that process all happens in the way optimally it does, then I've got great dream recall. Then I pretty much dream recall every night, you know, at this point. That wasn't always true, certainly not when we had kids. I was the primary caregiver and, you know, making lunches and all that stuff. But now my recall is pretty good. And so then once I write down the dream. People differ on this. I date the dream from the night before, the night I went to sleep, not the morning I woke up. People do that differently. Some people date it from the morning they wake up. I do it the night before because it feels like the dream is responding to that day's experiences for me. Bit of quality of sleep. You know, what was my, you know, I'll think about how long I slept, you know, good, medium, bad sleep. I keep track of that. It helps. I'll reflect just a bit on what happened the previous day, but briefly. I don't treat it as a day journal per se. It's more just kind of, yeah, you know, I talked to this person, or I spent a lot of time doing this, or I don't know, I had some weird thing that happened.
You give a title to each entry, right?
Well, I get there. I let the title, I actually kind of wait till the end to title it. I'll go through and I'll reflect and I'll, you know, play with it a little bit. I wait for
something. Do you note your feelings after each experience?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The feelings, you know, who are the characters? You know, sometimes there's a cultural reference that I'll play out.
Is what you're writing down confined to spontaneous sleep experiences, or does it include lucid dreams? Does it include hypnagogia? Does it include things from that twilight state between sleep and awake?
Yeah. Yes. I keep experiences like that, my reports of them separate, I guess, from my dream journal. I might refer to them in the dream journal, but when I had those kinds of experiences, I'd say not upon awakening, but say I'm walking somewhere, or I'm just sitting somewhere during the day, those kinds of experiences, yeah, I record somewhat differently. But actually, now that I think about it, in many ways the same too, because they are kind of coming from the same place, so...
In your new book, it seems that dreams are always associated by you with sleep states. But in fact, even in some of the dream journalists you quote, like Elias Aristides, who talks about visions in a space between sleep and awake, and to some extent like Anna Kingsford, who talks about the state before dawn as the most propitious state for dreaming, and sometimes you feel, as she writes about it, she's talking about drifting between sleep and awake. What I'm thinking is that we have experiences in all kinds of states of consciousness, don't we? Waking, sleeping, everywhere in between. And for me, in my life as a journaler, and I've been journaling since my teens and with vigor since at least as long as you, the hypnagogic state, the in-between state, has been the richest and most rewarding of all. And it all goes in the same journal with me. I absolutely do not separate spontaneous sleep dreams in terms of the volume I keep them in from lucid dreams, shamanic journeys for that matter, or hypnagogia. Yeah. So I'm just curious about how you come at this, because presumably you do have possibly more experiences than you've chosen to write about in that liminal state.
Well, that's certainly true. And in this instance, you know, this goes somewhat to my, I don't know, the contours of my career, I would say, or the way I try to shape some of the things that I do is that, living as we do at a time and a place that we valued or respected, indeed often dismissed, out of hand, the persuasive obstacles are formidable. And so I emphasize not to limit the further explorations of hypnagogic states and shamanic journeys. To be very clear, not to limit that sort of further extent, but rather to anchor dreaming in the experiential world of many of our fellow community members, you know, in the present day, who shamanic journeys are, they don't even know what that means. Hypnagogic states, they'd have to look up in a dictionary what that means. Sleep, they know what sleep is. And dreams, every now and then, maybe they have a dream. And so, to me, is sort of how are we trying to move the culture? And this book is very much about, you know, trying to move the culture on these issues. Connecting people, I find that stimulating more awareness about sleep almost always stimulates more awareness about dreaming. And sleep sometimes is an easier sell. It's a easier way to get inside someone's, get past their defenses and get past their, external armor and reach something where they actually think about their lives and how to maybe live better in a more flourishing and thriving kind of way. So I do emphasize sleep, and I emphasize experiences that happen with sleep for that sort of tactical, rhetorical purpose, I would say. My own experiences and such go off in all sorts of directions, but I, in most of my writings, that is the approach. Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I think we talked about this before, too, in some other conversation.
Kelly, because we have different experiences. And, our valuation of things, might be quite different. I mean, my own process of journaling, by the way, might interest you. I'm a polyphasic sleeper. I've never slept typically more than 2 or 3 hours without waking up all through my life. And I have many chances to be in a liminal state. I mean, I might get up and read or travel or write or do other things, and then I'll be in bed drifting in that in-between state. And whether it's a sleep dream or a lucid dream or a hypnagogic experience, the first thing I do with it these days is I'd email myself. I do a quick email report on my phone. And I rather like the idea of emailing from the dream space. Then when I surface in the morning, because the boy in me likes to paint and draw a lot, I'll typically do a picture from the image that has most juice for me. I post these on my Facebook page, so I can see the little boy say, look at this, look what I've got now, and that sort of delights the boy artist in me. And then I'll type it up and put it in my database, which gives me the search engine that Word provides, etc. And the search words that I use are a lot more varied and surprising than the ones in your form of content analysis, of course. They can be Sosipatra, which is the name of a Neoplatonist philosopher in Anatolia. The Sosipatra of Pergamon has been a character in my dreams. So I might have a word search for Sosipatra, not just religion, but Sosipatra, Neoplatonist and theurgist. Okay, well, let's go through your 7 exemplary figures. Who you present to us as dream journalists, which is fine, although, of course, the lovely Lucrezia de Leon wasn't writing her journal. She's having clerics write down what she said in the morning and
write for her,
the Mendoza clan in Toledo. I wrote a chapter about her in The Secret History of Dreaming, as you might remember. Let's go through them. Some are familiar to me. Some are less familiar, at least as dreamers. Some are probably completely obscure to most listeners, but we're about to make them aware of them. The first is an old favorite of mine, Elias Aristides. So let me hand it over to you and tell us what you have to say about Elias Aristides. And by the way, I should frame this with a question, which is your question from earlier in your book. You basically tell us that you're going to, the question that drives the book is this, Kelly. What kinds of insight can be gained from keeping a dream journal? So let's keep that driving question in mind as we talk about each of your 7 exemplary dream journalists. Elias Aristides, talk to us about
it. Yeah. Well, he gets pride of place as the earliest surviving dream journalist, and he was a devotee of the Greek healing god Asclepius, whose temples were scattered throughout the Mediterranean. They were sort of the hospitals or healing sanctuaries of the time. And he recorded his dreams as he sought relief from a variety of illnesses and maladies that, things that we almost surely consider psychosomatic today. A fascinating collection of dreams in a healing context. And what's one of the fun things I think about his collection of dreams is how often the dreams, you mentioned the trickster at the very outset of our conversation. Like there's a tricksterish quality of either Asclepius or other deities. Many, many deities appear in his dreams. Telling him to run around, just in his skivvies, or rub mud all over himself, or, make himself vomit, or just do all these things that the doctor's like, why are you doing this? And he found that his healing improved when he listened to what the gods were telling him in his dreams more than when his human doctors were telling him to do things. So it's an interesting chronicle of someone's quest for healing and through healing a deep faith in his chosen religious belief system. I mean, he through his dreams and this journal, this process, it was worship. It was a worship practice. So, which I think is one of the insights that comes from keeping a long-term dream journal. The practice itself becomes, you know, worship is a strong term, but it we could call it a contemplative practice.
I think it's stronger than worship, isn't it? Because this is the Aeolus Aristides, and of course for many in the ancient world, dreaming is a field of interaction between humans and the more than human. I mean, in one of the passages from the Sacred Tales, which I think you put in the book, he describes how Athena appears to him. She appears to him as she was represented by Phidias, the famous sculptor, I think in that giant statue next to the Parthenon. So right. She turns up in the approved style. They expected to see the gods in the style of the best statues that were made of them, sometimes in colors of gold and ivory, colors and that. And there's a fragrance associated with her, and he believes that he has seen the goddess in the form she has taken in a direct transpersonal encounter.
Right.
So it's not simply worshiping and praise and prayer. It's the face-to-face encounter that he's looking for. We're talking to Kelly Bulkley, his new leading dream researcher, head of the Sleep and Dreams database. We'll have to hear more about that. His new book is The Scribes of Sleep. We'll be back to talk more about interesting people from across history who kept dream journals. You're listening to Way of the Dreamer with Robert Noss.
Where can you find out about dreams and the dream world? MossDreams.com. At MossDreams.com, you can find out about Robert Noss, his work, and discover the way of the dreamer. Read numerous articles and essays on almost every facet of dreams. Find out Robert's class and workshop schedule. Read reviews and so much more. Visit MossDreams.com to find your way of the dreamer. That's MossDreams.com.
Robert Noss has a deep engagement with the dream world. And now you can take a crash course from this master of active dreaming at your own pace. That's right. You can get Robert's 8 exciting half-hour programs on a new DVD set called Way of the Dreamer. Share Robert's story as a dreamer and dream healer. This dynamic 3-DVD set can help teach you how to find your way through your dreams to realize your full potential. Don't wait to learn the practical dreamwork techniques that can help you understand how to attain better health, emotional stability, spiritual awareness, and more. Order Way of the Dreamer DVDs today from Amazon.com or MossDreams.com. That's MossDreams.com.
We're HealthyLife.net, reaching and helping a worldwide audience without hype, without shock, and without shenanigans.
Hello again, this is Robert Noss. You're listening to Way of the Dreamer, where we affirm the power of dreams, synchronicity, and imagination to heal and enlarge our lives. Our guest is Kelly Bulkley. His new book is The Scribes of Sleep. It's about interesting people who kept a dream journal or something that looks like one. We were talking about Aeolus Aristides, a famous orator, when orators were like pop stars and best-selling authors of the Greco-Roman world, who flourished in Anatolia, what is now Western Turkey. The second of Kelly's dream journalists is a Japanese priest who, interesting character, given to self-mutilation and extreme austerities. Mioe? I'm not sure how to say his name.
Yeah, Mioe is how I've heard it pronounced. Yeah.
Come again?
Yeah, Mioe Shonin is how I've heard it pronounced. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think I knew anything about him, so I'm a humble seeker of information at this point.
Yeah, he was a prominent monk in a couple of Buddhist traditions in what we call medieval Japan. You wouldn't think of him really as a role model necessarily. He was extremely ascetic. He cut off his right ear at one point to show his devotion to the particular deity he was worshiping. He fasted and got sick. He was very intense. Let's put it that way. He was very intense. And his entire life, and practice was devoted to, having an interaction with a deity. And in his case, it was the Buddha. And he, through dreams, through meditation, through visions, and he did record all of them, he sought, to be in the presence of the Buddha at the moment of his enlightenment, that was kind of his, ultimate spiritual goal. This is Miyoi Shonin. And so his dreams through the course of a 40-year life, he started as a teenager and he died, late 50s. So nearly a 40-year period of time that he, wrote down his dreams, his visions, his intense meditation experiences. And he didn't exactly interpret them because, again, to your point, I think that the goal was more the presence and the interaction and the encounter with the spiritual beings with whom he was interacting. So he became an exemplar in a Buddhist context for the value of dreams and dream journals as a lifelong, not just a chronicle, but a almost like an emerging map of one's own spiritual journeys and experiences and growth. Not many people know about him in a Western context. He's pretty well known in Japanese Buddhist context, though. So the dreaming monk is how he's sometimes referred.
So you just answered this, but let me put your own question to you anyway. You have just answered it. You tell us early in the book that the question that drives the book is what kinds of insight can be gained from keeping a dream journal. So what is the response that the study of Miyoi's dream journal brings? What kind of insights are gained from this?
Yeah, well, he doesn't thematize this entirely, but what's interesting for him is how, as a highly ascetic monk who was practicing, was getting down on other monks because they weren't intense and strict enough, his dreams were rather earthy. There was some sexual content and some sort of ego-centered type activities and aggressive things that we would think of as part of human nature, not something that would be of concern, but for an ascetic monk might be a concern. And so what strikes me in Miyoi's case, and I think this is the bigger insight, is that dreams are, and as we track them through our lives, they ground us in our natural being, even as we strive as strenuously as possible in spiritual direction.
And as I listen to you, I'm seeing a banner floating overhead, like one of those banners you see on little planes, at the beach, with a Jungian word on it, Kelly, compensation.
I'm just seeing it
floating in the sky above us as we talk about dreams that seem to be at odds with the formal vows and intentions of the monk.
And in his case, there are cases in religious history where that tension is sharp and a sign that there's something really more out of whack than I think in the case of Miyoi, where my sense is that because he was keeping track of his dreams and visions and such over time, he became familiar with his own depths in a way that some monks, Christian desert fathers, who are having, St. Anthony type temptations because they're so strict in their celibacy that, you know, their dreams remind them that that's not all there is to them. And so Mioe, I think, is an example of someone who found a way to kind of, even though, I don't know, it's hard to say. I mean, because he was so extreme in his practices, and yet he was very human in his dreams. So it's just that the paradox of a spiritual life, maybe.
What happens on those desert fathers, as I'm sure you're aware, is they develop some of those gifts or curses, if you like, that in the East are called siddhis. I mean, bilocation,
right.
Traveling beyond the body, showing up at a place at a distance. Is there any indication this is part of Nyoye's story, too? It's part of the story of so many Eastern ascetics. I mean, it's very commonplace in these traditions. I didn't notice it in what I read in your book, which is about all that I know about him.
Yeah. Unlike some of the other people in the that I talked about in the book whose dreams do sort of open them to paranormal-type phenomena, Mioe seemed like, I might be speaking beyond my understanding of his philosophical views, but I think that he thought those kinds of things were distracting. And that really, like, again, like, what the goal is to be like the Buddha. Like, he's almost like in a Christian context, someone who wants to be like a primitive Christian, right? Like, someone who wants to live the way Jesus lived, wearing what Jesus wore, walking around like Jesus, you know, someone who's view of the faith is everything else is corrupt except that pure original core, right? And I think Mioe felt that through his dreams he could connect with that in a Buddhist context, and everything else was a distraction, you know. So you and I might not agree with that, but I think that's how it
was. Okay, let's move on to one of my favorites, the beautiful Lucrecia de Leon, the little lady, the doncella of Madrid, whose dreams survived because a powerful family, the Mendoza clan of Toledo, thought that her reports were so interesting and so politically useful. Clerics who rode fast to Toledo with the reports every time there was one and survived thanks to the Inquisition. We'll have to take another break before we come to this, but it's a really fascinating story, which Kelly and I have both explored in some depth. So let's talk about this lady at the time of Spanish Armada, Philip II of Spain, whose dreams were a powerful, powerful political force. So powerful that she was arrested on the orders of the king, actually, not the church, to sort of try to control her and shape her narrative. You're listening to The Way of the Dream with Robert Moss. When we have Kelly Balkby back, we'll get the website where you can find his Sleep and Dreams database. Back after the break.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. MOSSDREAMS.com.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you're interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com. Get your personal dream symbols and discover the ones you dream about in Linda McKenzie's Symbols of You, a new book available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Target, and more.
You're listening to HealthyLife.net, the radio network that brings positive talk with positive change to make your world a little better.
The you're back with Way of the Dreamer. Our excellent guest today is Kelly Bulkley. His new book is The Scribes of Sleep. We are discussing seven exemplary dream journalists, as he describes them, from across history. Kelly, what is the website where people can reach you and your Sleep and Dreams database?
Well, there is the sleepanddreamdatabase.org is the site where, yeah, everything, all the dreams in the book in one form or another are available there for people to take a look at and see what they think. You know, it might, hopefully we'll see things that I don't see, but yes, sleepanddreamdatabase.org.
All right. Now, we started talking about Lucrecia de Leon. I started speaking Spanish with a Castilian lisp. I can't help it. Tell me a little bit about the conclusions you reached, and let's remember that driving question of yours, what insights can be derived from a record of dreams kept over time.
Yeah, well, I think probably what's drawn you to her story has drawn me and many others is that it's this incredibly dramatic and incredibly well-documented story of political prophecy through dreaming. And so, as I think you mentioned, I've written a book about Lucrecia. You've written some things about her as well. And the story is just, it's almost hypnotizing. You know, and I think both of us are scratching the surface. I think there's more to learn about her story. But in this book, in The Scribes of Sleep, what I really focus on is the process by which her journal was kept. She was illiterate. She was not taught how to read or write. And so you would think, well, how do you keep a dream journal if you don't know how to read or write? Well, she had these priests from the, you know, hired by the powerful families you mentioned, and her journal was created for her. And she was worried about this because, well, these are priests in the, you know, late 16th century hyper-Catholic Spain. Like, you could get in trouble if you dream something that's not in sync with the church. And she was told, oh, it's okay. This is in the context of confession. So go ahead, be honest, be truthful, because this will help the country. We you know, you may have visionary potential. So my reading of it is she was a sincere dreamer who saw an opportunity to do what she could. Now, she's also a young woman and had her own, let's say, will to power, and I think found ways to articulate her dreams in ways that are remarkable even from today's perspective. But I think what's, you know, as an insight, you know, you're back to the driving question. I think in her case that, hey, you know, this is what we've always suspected, is that paying attention to dreams over time, we really can see prophetic, precognitive foreshadowings of the future. We've sensed that in individual dreams, and when we look at longer collections of dreams, the patterns start to emerge even more clearly. And in her case, I think in the most dramatic historical way we know of. So it's really a wonderful story.
She was clearly very gifted in terms of her supernormal abilities, precognition, clairvoyance, etc. Early on in the scripting, in the recording of her dreams, she dreamed her way right inside the priest's cell. She saw how he was living
right,
when he was
right.
Taking dictation. He was so terrified. He tried to leave the job, and then, of course, she's at Sir Francis Drake's or Sir Walter Raleigh's house in London and so on, listening in on the conversation. Yes, fascinating case of how dreams can be of political and military importance and how we can boost natural abilities of intuition, precognition, clairvoyance, when our left brain inhibitions are down. Let's move on to another favorite, Emanuel Swedenborg. He is a man at the summit of all the sciences. In fact, he invented some of the sciences in Stockholm, you know, military advisor and fixer for the King of Sweden when Sweden had an empire. And in midlife, he turns into a dreamer and spends the rest of his life in wakeful ecstasies, he said. In between sleep and awake, Kelly, there's the dream journal, but then most of his records are from that in-between state of wakeful ecstasy, talking to angels, visiting heavens and hells.
He's an endlessly fascinating character, too, and of course churches have been founded in his name. Tell us a little bit about how you see him.
Yeah. Well, I think we probably all know more about Emanuel Swedenborg if it weren't for Immanuel Kant slandering him in a work written at the end of Swedenborg's life, the beginning of Kant's career, that the title was Dreams of a Spirit Seer. And it set the tone for looking at Swedenborg as this kind of fuzzy-headed mystic who kind of gave up on science and got lost in his fantasies. And the truth, I think, is very much the opposite. And much as I respect Kant, I think he got this completely wrong. I think Swedenborg is someone who has helped show us the potentials for, an integration is too mild a word, but the way that he brought together the best scientific thinking and knowledge of his time with a profound visionary imagination is just remarkable. And really, I think the kind of thing that when we talk today about how do religion and science potentially get along better, it's like, well, you know, Emanuel Swedenborg kind of had it figured out, you know, and we've lost contact with that. And so I focus on his dream journal because for a year and a half, two years, he kept close track of his dreams. And as some biographers, maybe not everybody would agree with this, but it seems that dream journal was a pivotal process for him, shifting him from purely scientific and engineering practices to cosmic Christianity, let's say. And his dreams were just by following them, and they also had a lot of weird sexual things going on and bizarre things that he thought about and put together into his remarkable spiritual system.
Well, we do have a quick riposte to those who say that dreaming has nothing to do with science, and I'm not talking about the science of dreaming and the science of sleep as tested in laboratories and brain waves and all of that. I'm thinking about the fact that Swedenborg, who may have been the greatest scientist of his day, and then when we come to the 20th century, Wolfgang Pauli, both world-class scientists are also world-class dreamers, and of course they're not alone in that category. So, you know, to think that a scientific approach and an aniric approach are at odds with each other is ridiculous. And here we go back to another of your basic propositions about keeping a dream journal. You say, and I'm quoting you, Kelly, keeping a dream journal means engaging in both a personal quest for self-discovery and a scientist's devotion to systematically gathering and analyzing evidence. Exactly. That's exactly right. I mean, your dream journal long-term is going to be your logbook, scientific in terms of the state of state-specific science relevant to the states of consciousness and reality we're dealing with. It's going to be that, just coming back to Lucrezia and to Swedenborg for a moment. He saw a fire at a distance of many miles in a clairvoyant way. Your dream log, amongst other things, is going to be your personal database, if you're looking for it, such thing as the commonality of precognition or premonition and clairvoyance and remote viewing and so on in aniric states. Going to do that for you. Well, our time is limited, Kelly. We've got one more segment left. We're going to take a quick look at your three remaining exemplary dream journalists, but I also want to confront you with your own question. Why did William James not include a chapter on dreams in the Varieties of Religious Experience? This is a very important question, and given the importance of James in your own approach to religious studies, we have to discuss that too. So we've got a lot ahead. We'll be back after the break.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. MOSSDREAMS.com.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you're interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
So we're back with Kelly Buckley, who, like me, is a reader of William James and, like me, values his book, The Varieties, Religious Experience, and no doubt much else. And Kelly raises the interesting question in his new book, The Scribes of Sleep. Why did James, who is so eloquent about the nature of personal religion and the need for direct experiential contact with the sacred and how that is the true foundation of anything worth calling a religion, why didn't he make room for dreams in a book as important as The Varieties of Religious Experience? He did write about dreams elsewhere. He wrote about dreams back in 1890 when he said that basically half the universe belongs to the dream world, half the universe. And then he also recorded at some periods in his life dreams that frightened him in 1906 in San Francisco. He recorded some dreams that confused and terrified him and made his teeth chatter, he said. Dreams in which he thought that he was several places at once and didn't know whether he was doubling himself, doublifying himself, he said, or in other people's dreams.
Yeah.
But it is a loss that we don't have a chapter on dreams and the varieties of religious experience. If you believe that Jane Roberts was channeling William James when she did the afterlife diary of an American philosopher, you might think he's saying a lot about dreams now. But it is a pity. It's a missing dimension, isn't it?
Yeah. As I say in the book, if he had written a chapter really going into dreams, I might have said, oh, good, well, somebody's done that. I'll go do something else. But but there it wasn't.
And he left it out so you could justify your own books, right?
I mean, yeah, that would be the Kelly Center view of the universe, yes. But it was more, I mean, I don't have an honest answer to it. You mentioned the dream that he had that came just, you know, that was just a couple months before the earthquake, too, the great San Francisco earthquake. So he did have a dream, at least one, that really made an impact on him. And in the psychology, he talks about dreaming in general, but he didn't include it as a religious phenomenon. And yet he is so able in his view of other spiritual phenomena around the world. And it's like, wow, that's a strange omission. I can always say that even someone as enlightened and thoughtful as William James had a bit of a rationalist bias against the weirdness and, you know, seeming triviality of dreams, or maybe they seem feminine or childish.
I wonder, if you put him in the context as I do, because I spend a lot of time with Victorians, I don't know whether you know this, but I am greatly attracted to the Victorian ghost hunters, the founders of the Society for Psychical Research, W.T. Stead, the journalist reformer, and a whole group that began in the Victorian era and flourished in the 20th century. I've read a great deal about these people. I've dreamed of them. And when I look at the men in that galère, the men in that circle, they're not dreamers by and large. The women, who are sometimes mediums and sometimes not, the women are dreamers. The women are, in some cases, keeping dream journals, and they're very interesting. But I don't think I can find any man in that set who kept a dream journal as we're talking about it. There are a few isolated dreams, but there's not the consistent record. So maybe it's a guy-girl thing, you know, in the frock coats of the Victorian era, that the men seemed, I mean, to think of James, he spends all this time at seances with Leonora Piper and so on. He was an authentic medium, I think he came to believe, and probably was. But where are his dreams? Why isn't he doing the direct stuff himself? So maybe there is something here about the male-female, you know, discordance
you know, in this era. All right, we need to go back to your survey of the seven great journalists. Tell us in a line or two about Banneker and about Pauly and in between
Well, the final three are all kind of on this point. They're all scientists. They're all scientifically trained people. Anna Kingsford, Benjamin Banneker, Wolfgang Pauly, all people who, very different context. Anna Kingsford living kind of in that 19th century Victorian era, a theosophist, one of the first women doctors, anti-cruelty to animals crusader. I mean, she was really a remarkable woman. She's to me, was one of the biggest highlights of researching the book. I think she's a saint of the dream research world. We should look more into what Anna Kingsford had to say.
Kelly. Let me interrupt you briefly. Thank you, because I had not read Anna Kingsford's book of dreams and dream stories till I read you, and I read that and got tremendously excited. The stories are somewhat mediocre, but the dream reports are thrilling.
Right.
And they carry me into looking in some depth in Anna Kingsford's life. There's a recent biography by an Aussie about her, which goes into some really fantastic stuff. So you led me back to Anna Kingsford. I knew a bit about her because her role in the tradition of the mystery orders and so on.
Yeah, exactly.
I had not read her dream book.
Fascinating one. Yeah, and then the American astronomer Benjamin Banneker, who was a free black man in the late 1700s, early 1800s, living in Maryland, a tobacco farmer by day, astronomer by night, created incredibly accurate almanacs based on, you know, he was uneducated black man, and yet he gazed at the stars. And while he was gazing at the stars, he also kept track of his dream. And his personal possessions were burned right after he died. There's a lot of racial animus, of course, towards him. But some of his dreams survived. And so it's just a way of signaling this remarkable, probably one of the great minds of the, you know, early American Republic, and barely known, and he was a dreamer. He was a dreamer. So, and then Wolfgang Pauly, maybe anybody in the Jungian world probably knows about him, and maybe you don't know that you know about him, but his dreams were the basis for a lot of Jung's work in the study of dreams and alchemy. They developed the concept of synchronicity together, and Pauly was a big dreamer and kept track of his dreams, and in his case, his dreams were truly inspirational for his scientific thinking. And so back to your point about there not being, you know, is there a tension between dreaming and science? And Wolfgang Pauly would say, that's a stupid question. You know, of course there isn't. You know.
Yeah.
And talk about paranormal phenomena.
He did call dreams
loved
his secret laboratory.
You've heard of the Pauly effect, right?
The Pauly effect, yes, of course.
Yeah, so he delighted in sort of radiating kind of tricksterish energies that would disrupt other people's experimental apparatus and break things strangely, and he enjoyed that.
My chapter on him in The Secret History of Dreaming is titled The Man Who Blew Things Up, and that's what he did. One feature of his dreams beyond what I wrote, and I think perhaps what you put in your book too, is Pauly was also a dream reader, by which I mean he is one of those people who reads a lot in his dreams and remembers and brings back text from his dreams. You know, this is another discussion which we see go back and forth among
researchers.
Can we read in our dreams or not? I wrote a piece about Pauly as a dream reader, someone who read extensively in his dreams and was able to bring back quite a lot. That's yet another feature of that endlessly fascinating prolix man, and tragic man in the sense of him dying so suddenly from cancer. Thank you for bringing us all of these exemplary journalists. We didn't really come back to discussing how you've used your reworking of content analysis. I think it probably works very numbers of dreams from quote ordinary unquote people. You've taken seven extraordinary people, Kelly. So bravo for trying to provide such simple categories and search words to them, because each of them is remarkable. Just think of the 12th dream in Anna Kingsford's book, in which she's rehearsing for how she will communicate with people in this world after she has died. I mean, I consider this fairly ordinary, but then I'm not all that ordinary myself. Anyway, thank you for...
No, you're not, Robert. Sorry to have to be the one to tell you.
All right. We've been talking to Kelly Belkley. We'll be the author of the Servants of Sleep, The Scribes of Sleep. We'll be back to say thank you and hail and farewell after the last break.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you're interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com, mossdreams.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Bringing such interesting resources, references, sources to us on the theme of keeping records of dreams across history.
Yeah, well, thanks for chatting with me, and I had a lot of fun with the book. It's a love letter to People Keep Dream Journals, and the Elsewhere Dream Journaling app is now part of the process. So maybe we'll talk about that next time we chat.
You are endlessly prolific. I'm sure there will be a next time. You keep churning them out, and thank you for doing it. And to everybody listening, may your best dreams come true, and may you remember them.